What impact is and will AI have on the core design tools of the future? To get the inside scoop on this, we welcome Tatiana Mejia to the show. Tatiana leads product marketing and strategy for Adobe Sensei. The company, Adobe, has been the leading provider of software tools for visual designers for over 30 years, and Sensei is their machine learning technology focused on solving digital experience challenges. My name is Dirk Niemeyer, a social futurist interested in systems that will make the quality of our lives better. My partner is Jonathan Follett, a writer, composer, and emerging tech researcher. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 3 of Creative Next, a show about future-proofing creatives in a world of AI automation. Let's get started. On our last episode, guest Josh Clark talked about how designers can use AI in the form of machine learning as a new design material. Materials are essential to designers. You can't design an automobile or airplane without understanding a vast array of materials, such as metals, plastics, and composites. Landscape architects must understand types of soil, water, plants, trees, and flowers. For the designers who rely on Adobe's Creative Cloud, the core materials of their work range from paper, pixels, and code, to fonts, color, and layout, as well as technologies like machine learning. In the decades before software became part of the toolset, these people were called graphic designers. As software and the internet evolved, not just the tools, but also the media within which to apply design, a complicated array of titles and digitally native identifiers emerged. These are now often generically encapsulated in a broader discipline that includes researchers, engineers, writers, and other specialties beyond just designers, called user experience. Since the rise of mobile computing a little over a decade ago, this particular design profession has exploded. This is reflected in the growth of Adobe itself. In 2005, a year before the release of the iPhone, Adobe had under $3 billion of annual revenue. By 2018, that has risen to more than $9 billion. That's more than triple. While this is the product of various factors, it is also a reflection of how many more people are using these digital design tools in the world. Given Adobe's size, influence, and entrenched position as the market leader for digital design software, it should be no surprise that they are also investing heavily in machine learning and artificial intelligence as tools to improve their offerings. And while, on one hand, the established nature of their software provides some constraints as to what sort of solutions can realistically be pursued and commercialized, on the other, their experience, product maturity, and diversity of applications and features offers a compelling foundation upon which to explore the potential of these new technologies. So it is that we are pleased to welcome Tatiana Mejia to the show. Tatiana is the head of AI product marketing and strategy at Adobe. An impressive and decorated industry veteran, she was recognized last year by Silicon Valley Business Journal as one of the top Silicon Valley women in AI. Let's begin by learning more from Tatiana about the software Adobe makes and how they plan to use AI now and in the future.
So at Adobe, we have a range of users. For our Creative Cloud tools, certainly we work a lot with creative professionals. We also have the Adobe Experience Cloud, and there we work with practitioners, marketers, analysts, advertisers, et cetera. And we also have the Document Cloud, and those are more of our business users. So we're really looking at the full range or the end-to-end group of people that make these digital experiences possible for their end users. Adobe Sensei is our AI and machine learning technology, and it is for the creation and delivery of digital experiences. We are thinking about how to make it easier, better, faster for our users to do what they do best. Adobe's been focused on digital experiences since the beginning. We're thinking about how we can create, how we can deliver and learn from our users. And so what sets us apart is that we're not a broad-based AI solution like others in the market. You're not going to see an Adobe self-driving car. We're not going to be helping identify or cure cancer. But what you will see is dedicated tools that leverage all of the unique data that we have and the decades of domain expertise to help power creation, delivery, and optimization.
Many large technology companies are using AI in broader and more far-flung ways. So it is useful to have the clarification that Adobe, a company with over $9 billion in 2018 revenues, is focusing their business and use of AI more narrowly in the context of their core user base and solution suite. In fact, as Tatiana made clear, Adobe's software serves a breadth of creative and business users beyond just designers. But what we're interested in this episode are designers, so we will deep dive into that specific profession. Let's listen to Tatiana share an anecdote about how her creationary process changed as analog and physical methods were replaced by digital.
When you think about how design has changed, it kind of takes you that same wistful road. I remember in college going into the darkroom to process my photos, and I had to be very thoughtful about what was my intent, right? I wanted it to look dreamy. I wanted some parts more blown out than others. Often it took multiple approaches to it. So if you think about that activity of taking a photograph and turning it into art or an expression, now we do that mostly digitally. And in a way, that's automation. So I think as things become commonplace, we stop thinking about them. You know, Adobe has been investing in cutting-edge technology for over 25 years. We have a dedicated research group. And if we think about AI machine learning, we've been working on this for over 10 years. Our first machine learning feature was actually red-eye reduction in Photoshop.
My father was a junior high science teacher between the 1960s and 1990s, and he actually had a dark room in his classroom, sort of a large closet, with the necessary tools and lights to make photography. Today, that is anachronistic, of course, and I suspect some of our younger listeners may not even know what a dark room is. But it is an excellent illustration of how design, in so many ways, has changed. Analog processes were physical, slow, and laborious. We made progress at the speed of the limitations, not the speed of our minds. As design shifted over to the digital, with tools such as Adobe's own Photoshop and Illustrator, things began to speed up. Making a comp shifted from an arts and crafts exercise with tools we today associate with childhood play, over to the mouse, monitor, and keyboard. However, it was still slow, even if better. The subsequent innovations and improvements have made this faster and faster and faster. Things like red eye reduction, which were magical options in photo editing apps some 10 or 15 years ago, are now automated and taken for granted. We've moved from slow and analog to slow and digital to fast and digital to now, in many cases, automagical. It's astounding the ways in which design in particular has transformed over the past 30 or so years. It's difficult, yet tantalizing, to imagine what will happen in the next 30 years. Adobe emphasizes that with Sensei, they want to continue removing the tedium from design. Let's better understand what that means.
I've not met a designer who got it like right the first time, right? They like to mull over it and think about it, right? People tell me that they know they're doing the right thing because they think about it in the shower. What AI allows you to do is to go through that process to figure out what you're trying to do faster. So let's just take doing a cutout. If you're looking at someone, or let's say it's a woman and her hair is blowing in the wind, you know what you want to do and how you want to superimpose it. That's easy, right? That's the creative intent. The process of cutting it out slowly, that's really difficult. When users talk about, you know, what they love about their job, you know, they share the variations. They share, you know, connecting with their users, bringing about a new design aesthetic. And then usually they'll talk about, you know, what they've paid to get there. And that has to do with internships where they were creating the half a dozen, two dozen versions, right? So not only do you have one image, but then you have, you know, the Facebook image, the Instagram image, the banner ad, et cetera. And that used to be the entry point into a lot of creative careers. One of the things that AI is going to do is make those beginning careers a lot more interesting.
In episode one this season, our guest Richard Buchanan continually framed design as a higher order activity, one about systems as opposed to the pixels that frequently come to mind when people think about designers in a generic way. In creating software that cuts out objects, instead of requiring a detail-oriented designer to painstakingly cut it out themselves, or that scales a core design across contexts instead of needing a person to somewhat mindlessly apply the solution in many different formats, it frees the designer, the creator, to spend their time doing other things. The job's center of gravity moves up from rote production and into problem-solving activities. This gives the designer the opportunity to solve more problems, or even to move up the value chain and solve different classes of problems. Software of the past and AI of the present and future are and will transform the profession of design more radically than almost any other profession we will talk about on Creative Next. To better understand how the AI works, let's see how Sensei evolves stock photography.
You know, finding stock photography is all about the metadata, right? And even if you think about Adobe Stock, for example, which is our marketplace, we have contributors and they put in everything that they can think of to make it easier for people to find their art. But they may not be thinking the same way that the end user is, or they may not get all the concepts. So you have things like, for example, a man, a woman, and a child. And you can get each of those, right? But you can also start to get concepts like family and fun. Or we were talking about, you know, my attempts in the light room, in the dark room, sorry, to make something look dreamy, right? That, you know, degree of blur. These are things that aren't normally tagged. But when you're searching for something, you think in these, you know, aspects, right? And then you try to translate. So one of the things that we're doing with Sensei is making it easy for people to talk about what they want and what they intend and find it in ways that feel intuitive. So some of these things are the options to select in the hands of the end user. So the things that I was mentioning, vividness of color, depth of field are in there. We can also get to concepts that we're hearing from designers, right? I need to produce, you know, a certain amount of content and I'm looking for things that have copy space or degree of isolation. So giving those knobs and dials so that they can find exactly what they're looking for. That's really the goal of how we're doing it. We also get feedback and do training, right? We're finding patterns. We're taking that computer vision and helping to enrich the information so that for the user, it just feels like magic, right? One of my favorite things, and you can do this now if you want to go to stock.adobe.com, is you search for something. You can also do a visual search, right? So you can drag and drop an image in and it'll find others that are like it. But even more than that, it'll ask you, how do you want this to be similar? It could be that you really want the color scheme or, you know, the arrangement, right? Maybe you want that long line into the horizon. It could just be the content. So you can do things like, for example, search for family, and then drag and drop in the color scheme you're trying to match. And now you have all of the stock photography of families that are in the color scheme. So these kinds of things, they seem really simple, but to get it right, it often took a lot of time and dedication.
How Adobe is making it easier and more powerful for designers to find stock photography is a good micro case study in core ways that AI and machine learning work, both in design as well as other professions. Stock photography has long been tagged with metadata that makes it easier for people to search. But with AI's ability to read and interpret images, it can tag them with a far broader range of terms that enable precision in the search. Oftentimes, in my own experience, I am looking for something specific, not something generic. Between the granular specificity of how the photos can be classified, and then the more advanced and user-friendly tools like a visual search, the machine learning layer is imbuing intelligence into the process that both saves time and adds quality and value to the final creative choices. Like many large technology companies, Adobe involves their users in the development process.
At Max, which is our creativity conference, we release sneaks. And these are things that are in research labs that we're working on. And we put it out into the community to get feedback from our users. Does this seem useful? Is this something you're interested in? What should we be thinking about? What kind of use cases? And we get a lot of feedback. You know, creatives are a passionate community and we love it. One of my favorite things from last year was the ability to take a picture as you're out in the wild getting your coffee. You know, you see something that inspires you. And then having it from that image be able to look back and tell you, hey, these are fonts are very similar. Now, not all sneaks make it into product, but it does show what AI is capable of, the kinds of things that we're, you know, thinking about and working on as we get feedback from our community.
This specific example can be applied, among other ways, as an extension of the stock photography capabilities Tatiana talked about earlier. The idea is to feed the software images that you capture out in the real world, which hold creative inspiration for you and, buoyed by the machine's ability to read images and the voluminous quantity of existing and well-vetted images already in the system, help connect you to more and better assets. It enables the designer to remain in the space of problem-solving, inspiration-seeking, and solution articulation with many fewer manual interim steps. Let's hear more about how these solutions tangibly impact the designer's workflow.
So when we talk to designers, a lot of them are just talking about the mountain of work that they're sitting under, right? You know, we talk about content velocity, but that what does that really translate into, right? You have to delight your users, you have to engage with them, and now you have to do it across many mediums and at scale. So some of the things that Adobe Sensei is really thinking about are, for example, the auto cropping that we talked about, and not just cropping automatically to the different sizes, but doing so in an intelligent manner. So as we look at an image, what are the focal points? What do we want to focus on? What are the crops that we think will be most pervasive? And we're doing this with images as well as video. So, you know, as you're shooting something, let's say it's for social media, so it's not a big production, but you want it to reflect your brand and the level of, you know, polish and quality that you want your users to associate. You may only shoot it once, but if you do a, you know, horizontal, but then you need vertical for Instagram, that's a lot of work, right, to do all the panning, or you have to, you know, just select a center crop and be happy with it. And so automating things like this is what's really powerful, right? Which is the designer sets the creative intent. They know what they want to do. They may even create the first one. But even if you think about for production or post-production, creating the variations, that's where AI is very powerful. It also helps with the ideation and being able to create all of those different versions. You know, as you're doing sketches and potential variations for your client to react to, being able to do that quickly means that you can spend more time on it, even with the increased pressure on production.
The variety of ways in which software can assist visual creation is interesting. While much of it is in production work, some of the examples here relate more to what I might call creative direction knowledge. That is, you generally need a person who is aware of and conversant in the various platforms of use that visual assets will ultimately inhabit. And in getting the raw assets, such as photographs, the broader creative direction must be taken into account in examples such as aspect ratio that Tatiana mentioned. Without that person, who holds that knowledge through their research or experience, you are likely to be disappointed, ending up with an incomplete palette of assets for the actual context of use that you intend. If the software contributes that brain, the tool becomes something that, on one hand, simply makes the creative's life easier and allows their time to be put into more of the core activities they enjoy or offer the most value, but it also may remove the need for one of the collaborators in the process. If the software knows the context of use, if it can suggest how to shoot to get the required assets, is an art director necessary? If we imagine a social media personality who is not a designer using smart software, is the designer necessary? Does the social media personality ultimately become their own creative director and designer in collaboration with the software? Let's pick things up with Tatiana.
So as we think about automation, the things that are easiest to leverage AI for are things that are easily defined and repetitive. So if you think about producing images for an e-commerce site, for example, where you may be getting lots of different inputs, but you want it to have a certain aesthetic, maybe even the same background color, et cetera. Things that typically these days are a list of steps, that kind of thing. Absolutely, that's going to be something that you can leverage AI for. The thing that is uniquely creative that we don't see a horizon at which this will be impacted is that initial step of what should our design presence be? What could this look like? What is the look and feel? How does the interaction work? The individual steps of how to create that make it easier, right? We talked about auto masking as an example. Now we have things, for example, we have content aware fill for video. This came out this year. And if you look at Twitter and all of these video post-production people talking about, they share stories where they're like, oh, someone asked me to remove the traffic cone from this long scene that we just shot. And they use the content-aware fill. Now, it may not, in most cases, they're like, it wasn't perfect, but it saved me hours of work. That's where AI is really going to make a difference. So it plays across the spectrum. It's definitely going to be very powerful in automating those end tasks where they've been clearly defined and now we want to scale. But even in the creation, it's going to make some of the more individual pieces easier to do. So you get the creative more in a kind of a creative director mode rather than a production assistant.
As we explored last season, talking about things like writing and marketing, much of AI's impact in these early days is around more production-oriented things. This ranges from things like design production, to writing formulaic stock blurbs, to automating the most common customer service interactions. While this, in the most literal sense, does make some jobs of old obsolete, it does not necessarily mean that the opportunities for a particular profession, such as design jobs, will start to be more limited. Looking back over the history of design software, even as early such software automated tasks and made things that once took hours or days now take minutes or hours, more and more design blossomed in the world. The profession of design flourished. There is no reason to believe these new advances will be any different, even as specific tasks and jobs do become obsolete. The opportunities will change. Designers just need to be thinking ahead and preparing for it. Speaking of preparing, what are some tasks Tatiana thinks will be uniquely for humans to complete in the years and even decades ahead?
What is going to resonate with your users? How are you going to break the mold? That piece is uniquely human and something that designers are going to do. In fact, we commissioned some research and did over 100 qualitative interviews where we were asking designers what they were excited about, where they felt they could use it, what they were concerned about. And the things that they talked about, I think, really echo this conversation, right? They talked about that they spend over half of their time on these more repetitive, non-creative tasks, that they really want to maintain their control while having more flexibility and agility. So many of them, I think over 80%, were interested in even getting away from the features to saying, can I have more of an assistant, right? Can I describe what I want to see and help you come up with the variations, right? So that's where people are going. Their biggest fear, which I think is the answer to your question, is they were worried that it would become homogenous. If everyone had access to these kinds of tools, would we start to see art look all the same? And that, well, that's their fear. And we can send you the follow-up to this research. It also speaks to what is uniquely human, breaking the mold, seeing new patterns. That spark, that's uniquely human.
A recurring theme in Creative Next is that AI is great within a very narrow and limited context, and terrible in any larger context, especially one as complex, dynamic, and always in motion, such as humanity, society, and culture. The core insights of designers that lead to things like trends and fashions on one hand, and the precisely brilliant solution for a particularly complex situation on the other, will not be achieved by machines anytime soon, likely not over the course of my career. This is where designers should focus their time, effort, and expertise as they prepare to succeed in the future, not on the making and fabricating, which the machines will increasingly do better than us, but on the problem-solving activities like research, analysis, strategy, and solutions. How is or will the management of design and designers change as a result of automation in the creative process?
I think it depends on which part of the design process it is, right? I think, you know, as we look at automating variations or creating things that are localized, et cetera, some of that we'll be able to leverage a lot of AI to automate, right? So I think that AI is a necessary and important tool that will help us cope and meet the demands of all of this content velocity, of being on 24/7, of having to stand out from the crowd. It will also democratize some of the creativity, which means that not every single change will need to go back to designers. So if you think about a partnership where you may have a, you know, marketing lead that is in a different region that thinks that for their particular audience, you know, you should change some of the text, or maybe a particular color resonates more. Having those changes go back full circle to the agency may no longer be necessary, right? We may be able to get to a point where an end user who doesn't consider themselves that creative, but understands and knows their users, may be able to make these tweaks. And so I think that that's going to close the loop and shorten the amount of time necessary to really customize and get to this personalization that everyone keeps talking about.
Tatiana surfaces an important business model evolution here. Individual design consultants, or agency businesses, currently rely on workflows where their ability to implement simple, production-oriented updates to existing assets keep them busy and billing and financially viable. This will increasingly be compromised and perhaps not be replaced by internal designers and creatives, but rather by people we would not typically imagine being responsible for overseeing asset reuse and formatting, people like marketers and product managers. Similar to my anecdote above, imagining social media personalities being more empowered to output good creative on their own. So in this example, the software will easily replace the most formulaic and procedural tasks which, in the process, allow business people to implement what were once thought of as creative processes, requiring the creative individual to make their money doing more actually creative things. Let's hear how this continues to extend.
So I think, like all good answers or all good questions, right, it's complicated. And the only complicated part is how we define design and creativity. I still remember when most campaigns had one lead image. It was everywhere. That is unheard of, right? People would laugh now with the idea that we're just going to go with the same image and we're going to pass, you know, plaster it on buses and we're going to have it on the website and, you know, printed collateral, et cetera. So what is design, right? What is creativity? Being able to select things. You mentioned text. I think that makes a lot of sense, right? A lot of the story also incorporates those pieces of it. People will be able to get feedback. They'll be able to understand what is going to resonate with your audience, or which medium is it going to resonate in, right? Are they going to prefer the video version versus the text version? Which words are going to get their attention? I think that the AI is going to give that immediate feedback, or maybe the better way to think about it is that transparency into their end audience. And it's also going to lower the bar for some of these things that I don't know that a professional would think of as creative, but I would say as a business person, we may be intimidated by, and these are some of those changes we were talking about, like I want to change the text, or I know that for my geo, you know, this won't resonate as well as this other thing. So you may even start to see a conversation where the designer gives options and the end user, right, the marketer, the advertiser is able to pull in from those and kind of create that final composite. We will see more of these, you know, creative capabilities in the hands of those practitioners. And I'm defining practitioners as those marketers, the advertisers, et cetera. We are already seeing a lot of integration. For example, in Adobe Tools, we have a product called Adobe Experience Manager. It's a web content management system. And the back end, you know, digital asset manager is actually, you have the option for organizations or brands to hook it up to the Creative Cloud repository. In some cases where it seems straightforward and the practitioner feels empowered, maybe they can make those quick edits. But they can also have a closer connection to their design counterparts and ask for what they're looking for. So I think we're seeing not just the volume of content necessary increase, but the speed of the, I'm going to call them round trips, right? Where you've created an experience, you've delivered it, maybe there was some optimization, some learnings, and those are coming back full circle.
The structure of Adobe's software already speaks to this blending of tasks and roles now in the present and increasingly in the future. The broad suite of Adobe tools include modules for not just designers, but a wide array of creative and business-focused professionals. Operating in the same ecosystem, an ecosystem that is increasingly integrated and bringing one another into each other's workflow and tools, portends a fluid future where the machines tend to the tedium and the creatives take on challenges increasingly in the front end of the creationary process. As someone whose skills and comfort level are more on the creative director than the designer side of things, this is certainly exciting. It also seems to anticipate a future where creation and creativity are more core to entire businesses, where perhaps the organization itself, as well as its output, is more driven by creativity and is designerly in the aesthetic, ethos, and output it offers to the world. That possibility is inspiring, and it is remarkable to think that it may be the result of advances in machine learning, as harnessed in what may become an entirely new take on enterprise software. To finish, what are some other AI-infused solutions that Tatiana is excited about and inspired by?
You know, one of the things that is near and dear to my heart is all of the variation, all the culture that we have across the globe. And so things that give me a lot of hope that I'm excited about is even using crowdsourcing to be able to create translations and databases for some of the smaller languages in the world. If you think about things like relief responses, the ability to get people to volunteer and to help the translations so that then the system can learn this, you know, dialect or language to enable first responders to get there. I mean, those are the kinds of things that I feel are really heartwarming and beautiful. AI is so dependent on the data that it has to learn from. And the idea that as a group of passionate, motivated people, people can crowdsource and provide that corpus of data, right? Whether it's language or something else, to help make something available more broadly, or even to help in preservation of it. I think that that's a real promise that I'd love to see us continue. I mean, we talked about the crowdsourcing. I think that's really beautiful. The other thing that I'm just really excited about is this idea of putting these capabilities into the hands of the users and seeing what they come up with. One of the best stories that I always share is as these things continue, there was a farmer. He was a cucumber farmer, and I want to say it was in Japan. And he created a cucumber sorter. Right? His family had certain things that they looked for as they decided what grade of a cucumber it was, et cetera. And they did the sorting by hand. And he created a cucumber sorter for his family's farm and really helped change what their economics looked like and what they were able to do. And I just think if a college student can help their family in cucumber farming, what could anyone else do, right, in the parts that are important and passionate to them? So it's kind of an add-on to the crowdsourcing, but this idea that AI is really helping the end users, right? The people who have a passion or something that they want to see created, that's really powerful.
Thanks again to our guest, Tatiana Mejia. So, John, how did our interview with Tatiana impact your thinking about the work we are doing with Creative Next?
Well, I had a lot of thoughts from Tatiana's interview and sort of reflecting on my own experience coming up as, you know, a graphic designer and layout artist and pixel pusher and all those things. So the first thing that struck me was it was very interesting that Adobe was focusing on removing the so-called tedium of you know, entry-level design tasks. Mm-hmm. So I think on its face, this sounds really, really great, right? Because, you know, if you're an intern, you're not going to be doing these things that maybe you're not so interested in. But I do think that it engenders a question for me, which is, you know, should all these repetitive entry-level type tasks be eliminated? And I'm not sure that the answer is necessarily yes to all of them.
Well, make the case, because to me, it seems like it should be yes.
Yeah. So to begin with, the things that you're learning while doing these tasks are not in and of themselves just about the task you're completing, right? So there's so much that's going on when you're, say, you know, I started doing, you know, layout of legal books using a wax layout, right? So you would dip the sheet into the wax and then create the layout on a board, right?
Board? How old are you, John?
Yes. So we won't answer that directly, but you can guess. And so software was just starting to come into the cycle here. But the next thing we did was we took it to photography studio where they would photograph the plates, right, from the layouts that I and other folks had put together. Now, when I was doing that, I learned how the print process worked, right? I learned, you know, sort of the fidelity that was required. I learned about the way that plates were made for the printing press. I learned a whole variety of things because I was exposed to those things because I was doing all this repetitive work. Yeah. If you had just given me sort of the ability to, you know, complete these layouts in a digital tool, I would not have had the exposure to, you know, those other parts of the process, which come in handy when you're trying to work with a print vendor later on in life. You know, 10 years later, I was working with print vendors and I was one of the few guys who understood what the plates, you know, like how things should be when they were on press. So it was the knowledge that I obtained very early in the process by osmosis, right? So it was part of the process. And I'm sure that you could parse out these educational opportunities that are built into tedious work. But I'm not 100% sure that you're going to be able to successfully do that. I think some of that's baked into it. And I can give examples from writing work I've done, from digital work I've done, where the repetitive task has provided an understanding of the structure of how something works. Like, you know, for carpenters, you know, sort of understanding, you know, when you're cutting the boards, like how they fit together properly, even though that might be a sort of tedious part of their job. So I think we run the risk of eliminating the exposure of how the guts of something works when you remove that entry-level task.
Sure. So let's say we wall those things off and put them in education. I mean, you and I don't need those tasks anymore. It's an absolute good for us for those to be automated. Would you agree with that? I mean, your argument is really one of education.
Yeah. So that the attitude that I've brought with me from executing on tedious tasks is that I'm willing to do that in other areas to become conversant or skillful in those, right?
Still about learning, though.
Sure. And I think that's part of it, right? Like, and I know that that's not, you know, a completely clear point, but the aspects of doing the tedious work have enabled me to go into other areas and fields and be willing to do those entry-level tasks to understand how things work.
That's still education though, right?
I mean, right. But it's learning by doing, right? Which we don't have. I think that's quite a good thing.
I'll use my own old school design education example. I mean, my first real job was at an ad agency. And I remember there was one time where we went and we took a tour of the print shop where the stuff was printed. It was hugely beneficial for me to see the presses, to see how things were boxed up, to talk to the printers about how they did their process, the whole nine yards. Super valuable. But I never went back again, and I never needed to go back again. Like, as an educational thing, it was great to have that once and have it up front. But if I had to trudge back there every single time there was a job to be done, it would have just been tedium, to use the word. So From an educational perspective, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. I mean, it really strikes a note for me. But for that to be an argument not to remove those tedious tasks from the process, generally speaking, I don't know. I don't. That's tough.
So I think another reason is to understand how things work, right? So on the flip side of that, we have let's say our parents' generation, right, that doesn't really understand how a lot of digital things work, right? And so, you know, my knowledge, it's funny, like I'm the IT consultant to my parents because I understand how digital things work. But there, it's very easy to fool my parents into thinking something is real when it's not. I just worry that if you don't understand how everything hangs together, then you're going to have a generation of designers that think that all these pieces just come together automatically. And, you know, ultimately, I don't think that that's a good thing at all.
You've become an old man, John.
I'm not arguing against the automation in and of itself. I'm just saying that you have to remember you are losing something in the process. And I think oftentimes when we implement technologies, we don't acknowledge that you are getting a benefit, but then you are losing other things that may or may not be well documented or categorized or understood.
Fair enough. You know, going back to some of the things we learned about computational storytelling and machine learning and writing, for me, this was another big proof for the ways that the current and next generation of machine learning tools will really make it easier for non-specialists, so people not trained as writers or designers, to begin professionalizing their ability to communicate or make things in ways that previously would have required calling in a professional writer or designer. We're heading into a really interesting period where creativity will become increasingly accessible and democratized. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think so I think we have a little bit of that now. I mean, the web certainly made it possible for people to get the word out about their mm-hmm. products and services without intermediaries. And so you're talking about scenarios where you can further shine the your brand without necessarily having to go hire an agency to do that. Now, the cynic in me says that all of the digital artifacts that are sort of fraudulent will be that much easier to generate as well. So get ready for highly sophisticated spam and phishing emails. Get ready for companies that look real that, you know, really aren't, because now, you know, you can have people churn these things out from whatever propaganda agency, and it will be, you know, just as easy as, I don't know, you know, pushing a couple buttons. So I do think there's a lot of positive potential, and then there's a lot of potential for creating, you know, I mean, for lack of a better term, you know, sort of fake communication.
So what did Tatiana say that was the biggest surprise or new kernel of knowledge for you?
Yeah, I thought of her comments about some of designers' biggest fears around automation were interesting, because I hadn't quite articulated this for myself until very recently. And Tatiana talks about a worry that things will become homogeneous, like everything will look the same. And so I've been thinking about this a lot lately in adjacent creative practice of music, of course, where you get a lot of overproduced music that kind of all sounds the same. And it's quite different from the sort of raw output of like the 70s, right, where people did sound very distinctive. You know, you can argue whether or not the quality of the music was good or the production was good, but you definitely knew, you know, sort of the individual artists. There were all the warts and blemishes that came along with the humanity of it. And there is an awful lot of music now that sounds homogenous. So I thought it was very interesting that she articulated that as a concern for designers and creatives you know, in that category, just because I think that might be a real possibility, at least in the short term, at least until we have sort of the algorithmic diversity to create stuff that's maybe less than perfect, mm-hmm. right? So I think that's sort of a new piece for me to consider.
Yeah, for me, the degree to which Adobe is seeing the entire creative process as, for lack of a better word, an enterprise concern is really fascinating. And it reminds me of the old product lifecycle management or PLM software that I helped to design. You know, that's sort of a core software for big enterprise software companies. And it made me think, you know, is Adobe's fate to be purchased by an Oracle or an SAP? Like, is that the logical conclusion of all of this? Maybe even by a Microsoft? So this conversation really expanded my mental model of what Adobe in particular is doing now and can be doing later, and how boundaries are starting to blur. You know, if you had said to me in 2004, you know, Adobe and SAP, Adobe and Oracle, I mean, I would have seen them as way totally different companies and considerations, nowhere near the notion that one could purchase another. So, yeah, just kind of stretching my mind around where these boundaries are and how they're changing and what's possible now. So, John, what did you learn from Tatiana that has influenced your life and how you're living today?
Yeah, so, you know, sort of referring back to my first two comments just about the idea that there's this need for human blemishes within artistic output, I've been giving a lot of thought to that lately, actually, within the music that I'm writing. And I think there's probably going to be some very interesting types of balance between using software to create things that could be potentially, quote, perfect, and then introducing, you know, these blemishes into, you know, whatever the artistic output is. Mm-hmm. So I think from Tatiana's comments about what Adobe is doing, I really am starting to think about how to balance those two items, you know, so the idea that you can have software that's AI driven to create some foundational elements, but that you might introduce, you know, the mistakes or the humanization in concert with that. And those two things, you know, might be able to work together. So those are some of the takeaways I got from her, from her interview.
So I'm thinking in terms of how specialized abilities and tasks could be universalized for my benefit. Adobe's software, it's bringing non-designers and putting them into a workflow with designers as well. And over time, more and more of the more simple or routine design tasks will become automated and not need the designer to complete. So given that, what other areas could this be in beyond things like writing and design? It's a big trend in AI across different disciplines and applications. And now I'm proactively looking out for ways that my own grasp can extend, either now or in the future, via these sort of tools. How can I professionalize myself with software to do more things, to bring, you know, more tools to my personal arsenal to explore new things and to have different types of success? And that's pretty exciting. Each episode, we finish up with a thing to think about, one question germane to what's been covered on the show today. This episode's thing to think about is, what feature could Adobe add to their software that would enable you to benefit from the power of design without necessarily needing a designer? Think about that for yourself, and feel free to tweet at us about it, @GoCreativeNext. Creative Next is a proud member of Civil, a community-owned platform for independent journalism. Learn more at civil.co. That's civil.co. We are sponsored by GoInvo, a design practice dedicated to innovation in healthcare, whose clients are as varied as AstraZeneca, 3M Health Information Services, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Learn more at goinvo.com. We're also sponsored by the Design Museum Foundation, a new kind of museum. They believe design can change the world. They're online, nomadic, and focused on making design accessible to everyone. Their mission, bring the transformative power of design everywhere. You can learn about their exhibitions, events, magazine, and more at designmuseumfoundation.org. Our final sponsor is Biff. As a purpose-driven firm, Biff is committed to bringing design strategy where it is needed most, healthcare, education, and public service, to create value for our most vulnerable populations. To learn more and connect, visit them at biff.is, that's biff.is. Please subscribe to Creative Next on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us at Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can get in touch with us at the Creative Next website, creativenext.org, or follow us on Twitter at @GoCreativeNext. On Medium, we are partnered with Towards Data Science, where we publish articles to extend and build upon these episodes. Check out all that Towards Data Science has to offer at towardsdatascience.com. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, whom you can reach at @DNiemeyer, and my partner in crime is Jonathan Follett, who is at John Follett. Thanks to our guest Tatiana Mejia, whom you can follow on Twitter at Tatiana Mejia. Tweet to us with questions, comments, topics, guest suggestions, and include the hashtag CreativeNext. And the home base for everything we do is at creativenext.org. We recommend you sign up for our low-volume newsletter there. That's it for Creative Next Season 3, Episode 3, but here's a clip of what you can expect to hear next time. We'll see you then.
What makes software a good candidate for automation? Consistency. What makes good UX, what makes good code, or even good features? It is consistency. We're able to determine patterns of repetition in something, and that something may be a good candidate for automation if we can do that.